National Council of Jewish Women, Pittsburgh Section, Oral History 2. Interviewers, Betty Schwartz and Selma Weiss. Interviewing, Nathan.
That's good. Very good.
Melamed.
April 6, 1998.
Okay. Nat, will you now please just...
Don't need that. All right, go ahead.
I think you better move that a little closer. I'll move a little closer to you. That's okay. Better. I think
you
I'll
want
come
to play it.
Oh, all right.
Is it on now?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Is there anything in particular that you'd like to add, information that you'd like to add, or some sections of your life story that you would like to expand a bit in this final tape?
Well, I think I've led a rather interesting life. I'm kind of pleased with the life I've led. And, considering that I came, when my parents came, we had no money at all. It was really a struggle. And I didn't really have any guidance at home at all. My parents were both intelligent and I think quite rather educated people in their own ways. But they knew very little about the way one goes about getting education in the United States. And of course, that was true, I think, of just about all immigrants. So I'm not surprised, nor am I faulting them. But in the process of getting an education, I really had to grope my way around, literally. And I did mention that my father's concern was really that I do something that would ensure me a job. And my concern was quite different. I just loved going to school. And I would have stayed in school for a long time if I could have. But as it turned out, I was fairly fortunate in being able to get through very quickly. I was also very fortunate that City College was available to me, because City was a school for immigrants and I think overwhelmingly Jewish immigrants. Immigrants of Jewish children, immigrant families. They weren't themselves immigrants, most of them. It was totally free, and of course that made it very possible to get an education. I don't know if I mentioned Townsend Harris to you, but that was really an extraordinary high school. My father hesitated because it would cost me 10 cents a day in car fare, a nickel each way, because that's what the subway cost. But so, in a way, I was truly fortunate in being able to find these places. It was a teacher in grade school who urged me to go to Towson Harris. I didn't know anything about it. I'd never heard of it, nor had my father. And the teacher said, when I was declared eligible, and I think it was sort of a citywide test that they used as a basis, he urged me to go, and I just transmitted that to my father, who was, as I said, initially skeptical, but he allowed me that, and so I did it. And I went to City. Now, if you went to Townsend Harris, you automatically got into City College. In those days, admission to City College was by scholastic average. And every year they adjusted the scholastic average a little bit so that it would so that they would take the number of students that were required to fill all of the ranks, all of the admissions spaces. But anyone who went to Townsend Harris automatically got into City College. And I remember in my year I entered, the admissions scholastic average required for admissions, if you didn't go to City College, was 86. Out of 100, it was 86%. So I was very fortunate, and By the time I got through City, you know, if I had my choices, I probably would have gone to a different school, because City was not the best school in many ways. It had far and away a better student body than it did a faculty. Unfortunately, the City College was part of the Department of Education, so it was included in Department of Education included high schools and grade schools and City College. And so they treated City College not as a university, but as a high school, more or less. And I think perhaps for financial reasons, there were very, very few tenured faculty and very few professors. And nearly everybody was called an instructor. An instructor or a tutor. And those were totally untenured people who got very poorly paid. And many were called tutors, and the tutors were in their 40s and 50s, and they were still tutors. Very, very few professors. And I know I've met some really distinguished people afterwards who had an opportunity to teach at City College, and they loved it because of the students. But they didn't like the working conditions or the pay. So, but still, the fact that it was available was a great opportunity for me. And then to go to graduate school.
Excuse me, how old were you when you graduated from City?
I was 20. I graduated, I was 20 when I graduated. I graduated grade school at 13. I graduated high school at 16 and City at 20. And then the war intervened. But immediately after the war, I started to go to graduate school at night. And after a year, I applied and got a wonderful fellowship that enabled me to go free of charge with substantial income to the what is now called the Polytechnic Institute, which is a school that emphasizes technology. And again, if I had had my choice and if I had known, I probably would have gone to another school, because physics was what I wanted. Polytech didn't really have a good physics department.
Is it in Brooklyn?
It's in Brooklyn.
But you did so well going to that school.
I went, and you know, but when I think back on it, I would have been better off if I had gone, say, to some other school, to maybe one of the better schools. But you know, it was really quite extraordinary that I was able to go there even that far. So that was good. And for that reason, I really feel that somehow I drifted in the right direction. and truly, it was a sense of drifting in a way. It's almost hard to say. But there was nobody to tell me, to help me, to guide me. And it was my own sort of intuition. And the fact that I liked going to school, and I liked learning, and I liked taking courses, that kept me going.
Yeah, you brought a few assets to this.
Well, indeed I did, yeah, but the fact, well, of course, what I can thank my parents for is the background that made it possible for me to think in those terms. That is to say, the culture. They brought me a culture of education. But beyond that, nothing. So in that, you know, I really considered myself fortunate in being able to do those things.
Let's talk about what you're doing today.
Well, fine. You know, I always thought that a person has to prepare for retirement when they're about 40. When I first came to Pittsburgh, I was married at the time. We had a child, and after a few years, I got divorced. At that point, I was looking around for some activities that would bring me in contact with a new group of people. The friends that we had as a married couple, I still retain, with one very notable exception, because of the partisan nature of divorce sometimes. I just felt that I was not going to be comfortable with one couple with whom we had been very close, but who were clearly much more involved with my ex-wife than with me. And although I don't think that in their minds they were the least partisan, I think that in their actions there was ever overwhelmingly a relationship with my ex-wife.
Didn't you tell us that your ex-wife returned to New York?
No, she went to Los Angeles.
But she left the community, as I recall.
Eventually, a year later, she left Pittsburgh and went to Los Angeles. She remarried, and then very quickly, very shortly after that, went to Los Angeles. That was about a year after we got divorced. And so the first thing, I had always had an interest in politics, and mostly left-of-center politics, coming from a basically socialist left-wing background. My father was left-wing from the Russian days, and he instilled in me the idea that government ought to help people. Not a very popular idea these days, but certainly one that Roosevelt encouraged. And I was a great fan of Roosevelt. I really thought he was one of the great men of this country. And I think still, to this day.
He didn't do very much for the Jews during the war, then.
Well, he didn't do much, but the fact is that, as American presidents go, I think one has to rank him among the top three. And he often is so ranked, not just by me. The New York Times had a ranking a couple of years ago.
He has an exceptional legacy.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And he transformed the country. He truly transformed the country in more ways than one. So as a great supporter of Roosevelt, I was looking for some political activity. It happened that ADA was just about getting started in those days. And ADA's founders were Hubert Humphrey and Eleanor Roosevelt on a national scale, and a few others. Walter Ruther was one of them. And in Pittsburgh, there were a number of interesting people, including Mo Yard. So I joined ADA, and I very quickly became active in ADA. And Molly and I have remained friends all these years. In fact, she's back in Pittsburgh now. So I joined ADA, and I immediately became active, and I was doing programs for them, organizing programs for them, and doing other things.
Is that how you became friendly with the Richmonds?
No. The Richmonds, that's a different relationship. When we had our child, our first child, he was adopted, David. That's with my former wife. We needed babysitters, and we heard of a group that called themselves Babysitters Club. Many of them were from the University of Chicago. They had all come to Pittsburgh, more or less as a group, because the University of Pittsburgh was expanding rapidly. And the Babysitters Club included Ray Richmond, who also had a baby about the same age as ours, and Jerry Rosenberg was one of them. I don't know if you know Jerry, but he had been a provost, I guess he was dean and Pitt. And Shapiro's, Zoltan and used to live across the street from
right.
And a bunch of others. And it was through the Babysitting Club that I met Ray. So that was quite early in our, I think perhaps after about a year and a half or so, that I met him. And he hadn't been in Pittsburgh long either. I think he came about the same time. But in ADA, I met a lot of very interesting people. Some of the people from the United Steel Workers Union. Ben Fisher was one of them. And of course, I met Molly. And Meyer Berger was one of the important members. And so that gave me a whole new community of friends. And I used that vehicle, in a sense, to provide me with the extracurricular activities as well as new friendships that I needed, because staying home, when you have a family, it's nice, but when you don't have a family, it's lonely. And I couldn't go out every night. I mean, I met women and I had dates and so on. And in fact, I made a point of making up for lost time. It's always nice when you get divorced, at least, to try to make up for lost time. So I had lots of dates, but still, you don't have a date every day. You have maybe, one day a weekend, or some sense, one day a week. So this provided me with good activity, and ever since then, I guess I've always been a joiner in that sense. I've been involved in one activity or another. And ADA was my first major organization here in Pittsburgh. And then I've always had a tremendous love for chamber music, even though I don't play an instrument. And so I joined the chamber music. In fact, I was invited to the board. I didn't ever join it. I started to do things for them that I didn't have to do. I wasn't part of the organization, but I liked them so much that I would provide them with new members all the time. And so eventually they asked me to join the board, which was a big surprise to me, because the board I viewed as somewhat elitist. It had, for example, Bishop Wright, who eventually became Cardinal Wright. He was on the board. There were a number of fairly prominent Pittsburghers on the board, so it was a rather high-class board of directors. And I felt a little bit out of place, not intimidated, but out of place on that board. When I first joined it, I can remember one experience when there was a question of how to distribute some tickets. And one of the women on the board, whose name I don't remember, said, well, she says, I'll give it to my chauffeur. I'm going to be gone all summer, and he has nothing to do while I'm away, so I'll have him distribute tickets. There were people who were attached, who were associated with big name companies on the board, apart from those that I mentioned. And of course, Ruth Montgomery, whose husband Edison was the one of the deans of the medical school, was on the board of directors. And I know, I've gotten to know them quite well over the years. And others, quite a prominent board of directors. And I have very few credentials, but I liked it, and I've been on that board except for a small lapse, because they have a rotation system.
I've been on that board, I guess, for 35 or more years.
The other organization that I felt very close to was ACAU. I think that civil liberties is one of the important things that we have to always guard. And for me, if I get involved, if I have a feeling about an organization, the tendency is not to just give money, but to actually do some work for them. And that's the way it's been. So I got on the board of ACLU, and that too has been at least well over 30 years that I've been on that board. And at one time I was state treasurer, and I've done various things for them, and I've been involved in all sorts of activities for ACLU. I was on the state board. I still am on the state board. So you've got ADA, ACLU, Chamber Music Society. I've more recently, when the Steinway Society was formed, I was asked to join to help them out, to get them organized. Something I did. Again, it's musically oriented, although my piano is not as close to me as chamber music. Still, I think it does a good job, and and I really do work for them. I got them incorporated, which was the first thing I needed to do. I got them I wrote up a set of bylaws for them, which was needed to get them incorporated, and I got them their tax exempt status. And now I'm trying to develop a program for them for, essentially a scholarship program, which we need to do. Because.
For music students?
Well, for young music kids. And I don't want it to be elitist, so I'm looking for something that will not give awards necessarily to the best pianist you can say. Because I know how that works. You get one kid who's really outstanding, and that kid walks away with all the prizes and intimidates the other kids, and people figure, well, you know, she's going to win, so there's no need to enter, or something of that sort. You know, everybody knows who's going to come out on top. Yeah, I don't want that. I want people to like piano for its own sake, and they don't have to be concert pianists.
What about need?
Need is the key. Need is the key. That's what I'm aiming for. Now, whether we'll accomplish that or not, just how to go about it is another matter. The other group that we love to folk dance. And in fact, Dorothy and I met folk dancing.
Right.
So there's a main folk dance camp. I got on the board of that, for better or for worse, and a couple of other things. I'm trying to get something started in Spain in music to change music.
How much time do you spend there a year?
In Spain?
How much?
6 weeks. 6 weeks a year in Spain.
Not necessarily in our place,
because this year we're going to take a 1 week train ride across the northwestern portion of Spain. It's a luxury train. You live on it. It's like a cruise on land. You live on the train.
Like the Orient Express.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
There are a number of such luxury trains that do this.
There's one in India, I think.
I think you're right. I think you're right. There's one in southern Spain, too, as a matter of fact, that goes Seville to Granada. It's a luxury train that's fully equipped with sleeping cars and smoking cars and reading cars and eating cars. And then you come to a city and you get off and they bus you into town and you can visit all the highlights. And they bus you back to the train and you go back to sleep. But this one, I know that dinner is in town, because one of the things they talk about is that in every town they're going to take you to the best restaurant that is characteristic of that region. So that's something to look forward to. But we'll be away 6 weeks. And last year we were in Italy for 3 weeks and Spain for 2 weeks. So it varies, but we go every year, at least once. Did I talk to you about Brazil? Anyway, you were talking about society, so those are my current activities. Spain, folk dance in Maine. This is Maine folk dance camp, and then there are three or four groups here that I'm involved with. It's kind of interesting. Dorothy,
you have an interesting activity.
Well, you know, I meet all sorts of nice people.
Yeah.
And truly, the people who get involved, for the most part, are really very nice people. I mean, occasionally, you find people who are hard to get along with, maybe, and they have other agendas. But the thing that binds us together is a common interest.
Right.
And that common interest makes for a pleasant relationship, because we're all working for the same thing. So, generally speaking, it's been nice.
So tell us about Brazil.
Well, Brazil was one of the highlights of my life. I must tell you. There have been a few times in my life when I felt a genuine sense of accomplishment and reward, and Brazil was one of them. The educational system in Brazil for many, many years had been built on the European system, which is the old European system, which is that every department has one professor, only one professor per department, and that professor rules the roost. He determines who gets what. He doles out all of the benefits and usually takes them for himself. Gets all the graduate students that he wants. And no one else can aspire to that position until the professor either dies or retires or someone assassinates him, which is probably at times the course that seems like the preferred course of action. The way they get around that process, if they have more than one qualified person to be a professor, is to create a new department and put that new department and put the new professor at the head of the new department. So you have now a multitude of departments. And for example, in the case of the university in Rio de Janeiro, the physics department, there was not one physics department. There were maybe seven or eight physics departments. There was one physics department for the medical school, there was one for engineering, there was one for sciences, there was one for, and each one had its own professor. And the worst part of it was that the professors were never there. In Brazil particularly, and I must tell you, this is not unique to Brazil because we found the same thing at MIT. In Brazil, all of these professors had outside activities. Now, for example, the guy who headed the physics department in the sciences, that is, in the school that included the sciences, he had his field was optics. He had a big optical company. He was never there. He was there maybe for 1 hour a day. And he had graduate students, essentially, or instructors giving courses. But he collected the salary. He had all the power. He sat at the Senate. He dispensed the largesse. And I would meet him on rare occasions, because he was hardly ever there, always a very affable, well-dressed person who would have to go off to his business connections. And he had a big lens, optical lens company in Brazil, and that's what his business was, and this was characteristic of the professors. And I want to tell you, Peter, when we interview at MIT, because MIT has an architecture school, a good architecture school, we found the same thing to be true there. The faculty in the School of Architecture at MIT is not a resident faculty. They have an office, but they have an architectural firm that they're associated with, and most of their time is spent in the architecture firm where they make the big money. And they use the MIT as their, how shall I say, their embellishment.
Credentials.
Their credentials, right. But they're hardly ever there. They come in and they look at what the students are doing. I don't think they totally neglect their students. But they come in once in a while, and they take a look, and they say, that's pretty good, and then the student goes off in his corner and works for another, 20 hours on the
project. Sounds to me it's essentially the caliber of the student and not the professor.
At MIT, it is absolutely the students that make, at least in architecture, that make the school. Although they have some well-known professors there, sure, so, the school attracts good students.
Yeah.
But that was the situation in Brazil. And then when the military had taken over the country, and then it became gradually converted from a military government to a technocracy. The technocracy essentially was ruled by a cadre of people. Nobody knew who they were. There were a core group of military, there were a core group of industrialists, some of whom were themselves generals, which is not so surprising, by the way. You remember General Sarnoff ran RCA. And some of them were highly placed political people from other areas, maybe from the church. These people met in secret and they ran the country, and it was really an oligarchy. But more than that, it was a technocracy because Brazil was trying to establish itself then as a major power. And at that point, they decided that the weakest link in the weakest technological link were the universities. And so they set about transforming the university system from the old European style to the American style, and particularly the American style as modeled on the University of California, where they had each, or let's say the land-grant school system, where each state in the United States has its land-grant university. And here it's Penn State, for example. That was established by, incidentally, by Abraham Lincoln. It's not widely known, but it was done over here. He wasn't the prime motivator, but he was the man who implemented the land-grant schools, which were initially intended to aid agriculture. So Aggie were the big schools. Anyway, they decided that each state, and there are 30 states, I think, in Brazil, that each state would have its own university. And that meant a